If you think of the heartlands of southern England as being a sort of rough triangle with London at the top, then it can be said that John Wesley often travelled down the sides of that triangle. He often went to Kent, and he also went down to the Isle of Wight very often, because he reckoned that it was much more pleasant than Anglesey or the Isles of Scilly or anywhere like that. And yet the strange thing was that although Wesley went down the sides of that triangle frequently, almost every year of his life towards the end of it, yet he only ever once went along the baseline of that triangle between Rye and Portsmouth. He knew nothing about the places that were there, and he knew even less about the hinterland. He knew of the existence of Brighthelmstone, which we call Brighton, and on one occasion he almost visited it. But there's only one occasion upon which we know definitely that he went through Brighthelmstone and ventured along the coast. He'd been on one of his visits to the Isle of Wight, and instead of following his normal practice of returning straight to London, he decided to go to Rye instead. And he writes in his journal, "I set out for Sussex, and in the evening reached Rottingdean, a village 4 miles east of Brighthelmstone. And the next day we rode over the downs to Rye, lying on top of a round, fruitful hill." So that is all that we know of John Wesley's association with this area. And yet I suppose it's true that almost every Methodist circuit likes to feel that it was visited at some time in its infancy by its founder. And a very remarkable local architect called Carlos Crisford, who was a Methodist, believes in fact that John Wesley did visit Eastbourne. He says in his History of Eastbourne Methodism, published a long time ago, which he called incidentally the Golden Candlestick, he says that Wesley travelled over the Downs and through Eastbourne by Brighton and Hastings along the coach route. Unfortunately, however, this route isn't the only one that he was able to take, and we're not absolutely sure whether he touched Eastbourne at all. What is clear is that he would almost certainly have stuck to the roads, because once one left the roads, there was the terrible Sussex mud, which was notorious for dragging people down and impeding progress. So it's a fair guess that he may well have just touched Old Town, and to that extent, he may be said to have visited Eastbourne. But really, Methodism didn't owe its origins to a visit by John Wesley. There was a Sussex circuit of Methodist churches established as early as 1765, but this was centred upon towns like Rye or Northiam or Robertsbridge or even Winchelsea, where Wesley is reputed to have preached his last open-air sermon. But as far as Wesley was concerned, Sussex meant the extreme area around Rye, an odd piece of geography. But the area became known as the Methodist Wilderness, because for so long no progress at all was made in the Methodist work. Then how did Methodism come to Eastbourne at all? Once again, we're largely dependent upon what Carlos Crisford tells us. And in his book, he says that it was brought to the town in 1803 by soldiers who were stationed here during the Napoleonic Wars. Unfortunately, that's the only information we have, and we don't know where he got it from. But it seems that when Methodism first came to Eastbourne, there was only a tiny Calvinistic chapel in Chapel Drove, or Firle Road as it is now, and St. Mary's Parish Church. But that in about 1803, the Methodists came and took a house in the Sea Houses, which is now number 27 or 28 Marine Parade, a Regency house that has been built on the same site. Although one example of the old type of sea houses, the tiny cottage that stood on the front, still remains. There they settled in and held their meetings in a room. We don't know what regiment they belonged to, although we think from information received from the Military Museum and from local authorities that it was probably the 11th Hussars. And we know also that the room was in existence because in those days, ever since 1670, when the Kent Conventicle Act was brought in, that Methodists wouldn't have been allowed to hold a meeting of any kind unless, first of all, they had applied for permission to do so under the Act of Toleration. And this meant applying to the bishop's court for permission to have a conventicle. And we know that this happened because there is on record at the bishop's court a copy of a license issued in 1810. And that was for the first real Methodist meeting house, as we shall see. But it seems very likely that it was about 1803, when the soldiers came to defend the coast against Napoleon's armies, that amongst those soldiers there were some Methodists. And it was these Methodists that began to hold small meetings in that little house in the sea houses. Fortunately, they invited some of the civilian population to come and join them. I say fortunately because very shortly afterwards the troops moved on, particularly when the danger from Napoleon had ended. And had they not made some civilian converts, then almost certainly Methodism would have died almost as soon as it had been born. However, in the year of the troops' withdrawal, a baker and grocer called Henry Beck moved to Eastbourne, and he set up his shop in Seaside, near to the King's Arms. He was a stalwart Methodist, and he needed to be, because when the Methodists first came here, they had a very rough reception indeed. Not only were they attacked by mobs, but also they were opposed by the clergy and by magistrates, just as Methodists were all over the place. However, Henry Beck stood firm, and his valiant work began to attract attention outside Eastbourne. As we've seen earlier, the Sussex circuit didn't include any part of West Sussex. And 30 years after its inception, the circuit was renamed the Rye Circuit, and the work began to grow, until eventually it was clear that the circuit would have to be subdivided. So it was that in 1807 the Lewes and Brighton Circuit was formed under the care of two preachers, the Reverend Robert Pilter and the Reverend William Homer. Dr. Coke, who was a leading Methodist at the time, told the Methodist Conference that the Brighton area hadn't been as fruitful a mission field as had been expected, but he said confidently, "We hope that the time is not far distant when many places on and near the coasts of Hampshire and Sussex, now seats of ignorance, sin and misery, will hear the joyful sound of the gospel." And meanwhile in Eastbourne, which was presumably one of those seats of ignorance, sin and misery, Henry Beck continued the Methodist witness. And in 1808, reinforcements arrived in the form of a farmer called William Heathfield, who'd come with his family from Canterbury to Crowlink. Early each Sunday morning, William Heathfield and his wife could be seen walking the 3 miles to join the Methodists at sea houses. In their arms they carried their children, on their backs their provisions for the day, and often they were accompanied by an old shepherd. And thus it was a solemn little procession which made its way to worship. The Reverend Robert Pilter, having heard about the meetings in Eastbourne and seeing their potential, took the whole work under his wing, and he formed the Methodists into a proper society, greatly helped by the Heathfields, who'd moved into Seaside by now and had set up as fishmongers so that they could take part in the growing work, and everything looked set fair for progress. Unfortunately, however, it was found difficult to provide preachers to take care of the needs of the pulpit and of the parishioners. And so the preachers used to have to come from 15 or 20 miles, often over terrible roads in all kinds of weather. And the Heathfields used to set aside a room in their house where they would entertain the preachers. And after they conducted a full Sunday services, they would have to be up and walk back their 15 or 20 miles to begin their work. And the Heathfields always used to make sure that they had a hot breakfast before they set out, which often had to be prepared before 4:30 in the morning. Nevertheless, infant Methodism obviously wasn't to be destroyed either by the persecutions from outside or by problems of administration inside. It was beginning to grow and thrive. From the moment that Eastbourne Methodism attracted the attention and the enthusiasm of the Reverend Robert Pilter, its prospects brightened. He'd had some experience of building chapels, and he decided that Eastbourne Methodists should have a chapel of their own. And so, in September 1809, a plot of land was purchased in Southbourne, one of the villages that made up Eastbourne in those days. It was bought from a prominent landowner called Willard for the princely sum of £145. And the Methodists watched their chapel grow. On the 9th of March 1810, that entry was made in the diocesan records of dissenting chapels. It reads, "A meeting or assembly for the religious worship of the people called Armenian Methodists, to be held in a certain chapel lately built for that purpose, situate at Southbourne, in the parish of Eastbourne, in the county of Sussex." The chapel was opened at a cost of £861.16.3. Its exact site was in some doubt, because some writers said it was in South Street, but it seems fairly certain that it was in Grove Road. It is said that it was opposite to the New Inn, but it was certainly at the top of Grove Road, and there are still photographs of it in existence. The society was faced with a considerable debt, of course, and this had to be repaid over a long time by promissory notes. The chapel couldn't really have been built at a better time, because Eastbourne was expanding, and soon it became necessary to add some extra pews, and the chapel was often filled. The work in Methodism generally was growing. The area around Brighton was certainly becoming more prosperous. And in 1811, it was decided to move the headquarters of the new circuit to Brighton itself. What was important about this was that it was decided that Eastbourne had become so important that one of the preachers stationed in the circuit should always be stationed in Eastbourne from time to time. So the Methodists managed to get the preaching and the pastoral care that they needed. Nevertheless, hard times were ahead. In 1815, the Napoleonic Wars ended and the troops were dispersed, the militia disbanded and unemployment was rife. The old cavalry barracks were turned into a workhouse, and parents of children who were poor were instructed to send their children to learn a useful trade, girls over 9 and boys over 8 years of age. Otherwise, they were told they would have their poor relief reduced. And Methodism felt the pinch too. The minutes of meetings held at that time show an almost obsessive concern about the high cost of candles, for instance. They were also to feel the effects of the economic depression in a more personal way, because in 1817 the great pioneer Henry Beck and his family joined the migration away from Eastbourne and moved to Hastings, where they had to begin their work all over again. The 5 years after the end of the Napoleonic Wars were some of the most difficult that the town and the Methodists had known. But after 1820, the fortunes of the town improved. However, it doesn't seem that the Methodists experienced a similar improvement of their situation. The society had 34 members, virtually no increase for many years. And the work was made more and more difficult. Often visiting preachers weren't able to arrive for their appointments, and they had to be taken by one or two local stalwarts. Amongst these were a retired Coast Guard officer, Mr. Buss, and a certain Miss Morris. They were faithful enough people, and they kept the work going. But it prospered again when William Pollard came to give a hand. His father kept the toll gate at Langney, and he'd married one of the Heathfields' daughters, and so he became very interested in the work in Eastbourne, although he had to travel from Uckfield in all weathers to preach. When he had to give up his work, they hired another hired local preacher, as they were called. His name was William Fisher, and a very eccentric character he was too. He was filled with evangelistic zeal, And on one occasion, it said, he stopped a complete stranger on the road and inquired after the state of her soul. Finding that she wasn't converted, he talked to her at great length and made her kneel in prayer with him on the beach and didn't allow her to stand up again until she was thoroughly saved. Meanwhile, Eastbourne was continuing to grow and flourish, and at last its Methodism seems to have grown with it, because the seating capacity of the chapel had to be enlarged by the addition of a gallery. And we are fortunate to have an actual eyewitness of the chapel and its worship from a certain Robert Cooper. And this is worth reading in full. The building itself, he said, had no architectural pretensions whatsoever. It was a large, square-shaped room with plain, flat ceiling and whitewashed walls. The pews were of deal, unpainted, and underneath the pulpit was a larger pew than the rest, where the singers used to sit, and was called the singing pew. In addition to the singers, there were occasionally a bass viol and a flute, played by two knights of the last. Presumably, by that he means that they were blacksmiths. And it was customary for the minister to give out the hymns half a verse at a time. From what I recollect, he says, it was not a very cheering performance. The building was lighted with candles placed in upright iron candlesticks affixed to the tops of the pews. On each side of the pulpit was a brass candlestick containing two candles each. It was the duty of the attendant to go round every quarter of an hour to snuff the candles and to mount the pulpit for the same purpose in the event of the minister failing to do so. We also owe to Robert Cooper some reminiscences about some of the preachers, particularly the Reverend William Winter Annett, or Old Annett's as he was called, a retired minister who'd found in his old age the consolation of a rich widow in Eastbourne. He was reputed to be rather fond of alcoholic stimulants, and on occasion was too stimulated to preach. His style of preaching was picturesque, to say the least. When he was about to say something of particular importance, he warned the congregation of the impending event by seizing one of the candlesticks in both hands and rolling his eyes in a most alarming way. And he was a great believer in the effectiveness of preaching hellfire. And on one occasion he said to the congregation, "Did any of you ever have toothache?" And then he proceeded to tell them that the pain that they felt then was a mere flea bite compared with what they might expect eternally if they didn't repent. Another of the preachers was a tin plate worker called Gurr, whose preaching was so bad that he had to be spoken to about it, but he just didn't take any notice. However, the society was spared his further ministrations because he absconded. A local butcher caught him climbing over a wall in Ivy Terrace with a young lady. He was going to elope with her. Well, he had owed the butcher some £13, and so the butcher wouldn't let him go until he'd paid up. But once he'd paid up, he was allowed to go and disappeared, and nobody knew where he or the lady went. There were also odd folk in the congregation, too. There was a generally drunk doctor entitled Nicholas Williams, who would wait for the meetings to start, and then, after the service had begun, stick in hand, he would take his place in the pew, right next to the minister, where he would sit, and he would peer around at the congregation, taking very little notice of the worship. And when he'd had enough, or when he was rested, he would then rise from his seat and leave as ostentatiously as he'd entered, to join his friends in the nearest alehouse. So obviously, amongst the first Methodists, both preachers and people, there were many characters. However, despite the new gallery, things didn't remain rosy for long. In 1840, the Methodist Conference was alarmed at the state of affairs in the Methodist wilderness. And it seemed as though there was very little hope of success. But just in time, a very remarkable man began to take an interest in Eastbourne Methodism. Thomas Scott was a lay preacher from Lewes, who first visited Eastbourne in 1841 and took the work to his heart. He offered to help the society and often preached even half the Sundays in the year. He was tireless in his efforts. He would walk from Lewes at all times of day and night, and he continued to do this until a fall from a carriage prevented him doing it any longer. But he still kept up his interest in the society, and it was a good thing that he did, because one Sunday evening there was a terrible storm in Eastbourne, And the Methodists arrived for their Sunday service to find that the gallery had collapsed. Nothing daunted, they took to the open air. And the preacher stood on a tar barrel and promptly stuck to it, so that he had to keep lifting first one foot and then the other. At least that didn't stop him preaching. Nevertheless, his efforts were blessed. In 1851, there was an ecclesiastical census taken in the country, which gave some indications of the number of people in church on the 30th of March. And on that date, the morning congregation at Eastbourne Methodist Chapel was recorded as 116, and in the evening, 140. So things were improving. But then Thomas Scott had to move to London, but still he didn't forget Eastbourne Methodism. He went to see the Reverend Francis West and persuaded him that it was absolutely essential that a resident minister should be stationed in Eastbourne. In 1860, the conference assigned the Reverend J. A. B. Harry to the Lewis and Eastbourne circuit to reside at Eastbourne. The Methodist dream had come true. They had a minister of their own. And when the young minister arrived to take up his duties, who should be there to greet him and encourage him but the magnificent Thomas Scott? And still Scott hadn't finished. He urged that a new and better chapel should be built, and he gave the first £25 towards the building fund. Things were now really beginning to move. The site was acquired for the new chapel. It stood on the newly formed Pevensey Road, where it backed onto marshland and cultivated fields. A site about 80 feet by 80 was leased by the Duke of Devonshire until finally its freehold was acquired in 1873. The foundation stone was laid on the 11th of November 1863 by Sir Francis Lycett, one of the great Methodist laymen of the day. And under the foundation stone was placed a glass bottle containing a record of the stone laying, a copy of the weekly Methodist paper The Watchman, and a few small coins. These were found when the church was taken down in 1908 and were replaced under the same stone, which is now built into a wall in the porch leading to the minister's vestry. The foundation stone couldn't really have been laid at a less auspicious time, because in that very year there was a fearful outbreak of scarlet fever, then a killer disease. And the visitors and the inhabitants fled from the town, 200 families a day. The town lost £1 million in revenue and its reputation as a healthy place. The rents of furnished accommodation fell dramatically. But still, the Methodist work was in hand and it had to go ahead. In July 1864, they sold their Southbourne Chapel in Grove Road to the Baptists, and they opened their new chapel in Pevensey Road at the cost of £1,874.16.7. And people came from far and near to hear the great Dr. Punchin, who was to be the preacher that day. And a real spellbinder he was. These popular preachers had something of the reputations of pop idols today. When he preached in Cornwall, the police had to be called in to drive off the mob that was fighting to get into the church to hear him. And his effect upon the congregation in Eastbourne was a little more dignified, but no less enthusiastic. Immediately after the opening service, Dr. Punchin had to return to London, but the festivities continued. A tent had been erected in the field at the back of the new chapel, and the worshippers joined for a picnic tea. And here there was a problem. You may dispute with a Methodist about his doctrine, and he will forgive you, but he will find it much more difficult to forgive you if you tamper with his tea. And one of the few clouds on the horizon that day was a cloud of smoke, which found its way into the tea from the furnace which had been erected to boil the water. Nevertheless, the grumbles were soon short-lived, because the crowds were looking forward to the evening meeting when they were treated to a number of addresses, but the main one was by another star preacher, the Reverend J. Brocklehurst, who seems to have come to take the place of the absent Dr. Punchin. It had been a glorious day, and even the weather had been kind. So the work continued to grow. In 1869, the Methodists decided to turn their attention to the provision of a Sunday school building, and a piece of land was acquired behind the chapel for the purpose. Remembering past debts, the trustees resolved that the work would only go ahead as funds became available, and consequently there was a very odd stop-go approach to the project. resulting in the building being used for some time, even without proper flooring, because the contract for floors and joists was the last to be given. And maybe the building would have remained flawless had it not been for the fact that the Department of Education was looking for school premises, and the Reverend Lancelot Railton brought off something of an educational coup by offering the new premises for a school under the headship of a Methodist, Mr. J.C. Wright. He even persuaded the Duke of Devonshire to give the site to the trustees so that the work could be completed with grants from the Education Department. In 1871, the circuit felt very proud because it became a circuit in its own right. The membership rose to 123. The new chapel from Hailsham was entrusted to the care of the Eastbourne Circuit. And as far as the Pevensey Road Chapel was concerned, its growing popularity with residents and visitors meant that its comfort had to be improved. In 1875, a heating system was installed at the cost of £100, and a gallery was added costing £224.13. The following year, the inevitable bazaar was held to raise the necessary money. And it's interesting that its expenses included £1 for the town crier, £10 for the police, and £3 for the band. Now that the work in the centre of the town was consolidated, the Wesleyans turned their attention to the East End, where there was considerable development of more humble dwellings. And they acquired the use of 6 Rose Terrace for their meetings. But Carlos Crisford says that the going was very hard indeed. And he says that influences unfavourable to aggressive work soon became manifest. What these were, we really don't know. We imagine that there must have been some mob activity, but also the Anglicans had become very active in that part of the town. This was an era of great church building, and right in the area into which the Wesleyans had moved, Christ Church was built in 1859 and placed under the care of the Reverend W.H. Lloyd, who was described as a popular and successful little man. And then also All Souls was opened on the fringe of the area, and it took its fiercely evangelical tone from its patroness, Lady Victoria Wellesley, who it was said had a deep aversion to Romanizing rituals. And so faced by this formidable Anglican presence, the Wesleyans felt that they needed to have premises of their own. But all they could find was a workshop entered by a devious passage from Eshton Road. But they began their work there, largely amongst the children, who were ragged, rude, and mischievous. And bit by bit, they won their confidence. But in no time at all, the workshop was too small for their needs. And so, during the ministry of the Reverend David Thomas, a church with a Sunday school underneath it was built in Beamsley Road, and opened in August 1886. An act of faith which was richly justified, because soon both chapel and school were filled to overflowing. And the Beamsley Road Chapel can still be seen. It's now, I believe, an electrical contractor's. Unfortunately, no such success story could be reported by the Wesleyans when they turned their attention from one of the newest parts of the town to one of the oldest. Because in 1888, services were begun in Hurst Road, Old Town, and later were transferred to a small hall over a greengrocer's shop in Ockling Road. A Sunday school was begun, but its success was nothing like that experienced at Beamsley Road. One of the major problems seems to have been a legal one, because Carlos Crisford makes a mysterious reference to the reviving of the Act of Toleration. Now, this is strange, because the limitations put upon dissenters were beginning to be eased at this time. And we have to remember that the purpose of the Act was to protect the rights of dissenters, not to hinder them. We can guess that perhaps the problem was that the vicar of St. Mary's distrusted the arrival of the Wesleyans, which would be quite natural, because we need to remember that his predecessor's son had recently set up St. Edmund Hall, very near to the parish church. One lot of dissenters looked very much like another to the establishment at that time. So it looks as though the Wesleyans may have run into some official disapproval. But whatever the precise nature of the opposition was, it was significant enough to bring the work almost to an end. No such uncertainties seem to have bothered Eastbourne Wesleyans as a whole. And in 1890, the Wesleyan Mission Band was started with its motto, Souls for Christ. This was a remarkable piece of organisation which met each Monday evening at the late hour of 9 o'clock in the evening, when most of its members would have done more than a hard day's work. They had, of course, to be teetotalers, and they had to be committed to conducting evangelistic services both in chapels and in the open air. They made a special point of, as they put it, claiming bank holidays for the master by holding big meetings both indoors and out. On one occasion, close on 2,000 people met on Eastbourne's foreshore for such an open-air service. Thousands of tracts were delivered to homes and handed out in streets. Adherents were visited and full-scale programmes of aggressive evangelism were undertaken. Once again, the circuit's evangelistic zeal was turned to one of the outposts. As early as 1865, a membership of 10 had been reported at Handcombe, and the work had grown so fast that when the Duke of Devonshire gave a piece of land there for the erection of a chapel, the opportunity to build was seized. Incidentally, this gift came just in time because the Duke died in the following year, and it's worth noting that very few of the great landed gentry of the country treated Wesleyans with such generosity and sympathy as the 7th Duke of Devonshire. Steps were taken to put the building in hand when opposition came from an unexpected source. The Congregationalists had also been experiencing a revival, and their church in Pevensey Road was one which rivaled the Wesleyans in finery. When they heard of the proposed new chapel, they protested that it would be too near to their own chapel, which was on near to the Red Lion public house just off the present Polegate West Ham Road. Well, ecumenical relations weren't as advanced then, and the Wesleyan trustees simply replied to the protest by giving orders that their chapel should be completed. And so it was, at a cost of £139, and is now known as Black Nest. Interdenominational relations appeared in a happier light when the Wesleyans gave their support to the Salvation Army when it arrived in Eastbourne. It had a very rough reception, but its main obstacle was that in 1885 the Eastbourne Improvement Act was put through Parliament, and one of its effects was to prevent the Salvation Army using its band for public services on Sunday, because it dragged down the tone of the town. Now, the Wesleyans also had a silver band which they used at their open-air services, and so when the Salvationists refused to abide by the new law, the Wesleyans supported them. Eventually, a dissenter, Sir H.H. Fowler, persuaded Parliament to repeal the Act, much to the fury of many local inhabitants, who said that the members of Parliament had been intimidated by the Salvationists, and also, of course, by the thought of an impending election. Further interdenominational squabbles were ahead. In 1870, Gladstone's government had grasped the nettle of national education and had brought in measures which, in effect, doubled the grants made to Church of England schools while augmenting them with new publicly controlled board schools. The Nonconformists opposed the measures which favoured Anglican schools at the expense of their own, but they were ready to surrender many of their own institutions to the new school boards, and it's apparently what happened in Eastbourne. The Wesleyan Day School, as it was called, was closed, much to the fury of the Anglicans, who thought that they had done it on purpose. A contemporary writer says, "The spirit which actuated the dissenters at this time is sufficiently shown by their having, in a very spiteful spirit, brought about the closing of the Wesleyan School, which they hoped and expected churchmen would be unable to face. But in this our dissenting brethren were sold. The Anglicans raised a vast amount of money and succeeded in saving their own schools." In 1894, a piece of land was bought at Willingdon, where the work was well prepared by open-air mission services. And with the amazing celerity with which chapels seemed to have been built in those days, the building was opened in September of the following year, at a total cost of £403, 2 shillings and 5 pence. The Pevensey Road obviously thought itself as a bit of a trendsetter, and also very much in the van of the social movements of the day. In 1897, the Eastbourne Gazette records that there were 167 members in the Wesleyan Working Man's Slate Club, and a library was formed, boasting 400 books and 78 readers. Perhaps it was the encouragement of the situation at Willingdon which gave the circuit the heart to tackle the plight of the old town area again, where things had almost ended. And in view of this, instead of withdrawing, it was decided that they should build a new chapel at Greenfield Road in 1897. It's at this point that we first hear of the activity in Eastbourne of another great section of the Methodist movement, the Primitive Methodists. Hitherto, we've been talking about the Wesleyans. In the same year that Greenfield Road was put in hand, deeds were submitted to trustees for the signature for the building of a Primitive Methodist chapel in Longstone Road. We'll have cause later to return to their activities, but at this point we ought to notice the beginnings of their work. So as the new century dawned, the circuit was presented with a new chapel. Hitherto it had always had to pay for them and build them itself, but now it was presented with a new chapel at Gamelands by a Mr. George Wheen, who gave it in 1900 to meet the needs of the group of worshippers who'd been meeting in his drawing room. And in Eastbourne itself, a programme of evangelism was pursued with vigour. Evangelists took their services in Greenfield and Beamsley Road chapels. However, it was realised that what was needed was an overall strategy for mission. And an extension committee was formed, which awoke the circuit to the evangelistic opportunities presented by the town's holiday industry. And it declared that it had as its purpose the provision of a new church at the East End and also a central church. The circuit lost no time in implementing the first part of the committee's plan, the provision of a new church at the East End, and in 1903 the trustees accepted a tender for the building of Wesley Hall. The following year the Beamsley Road Chapel was sold, and the president of the conference, the Reverend Marshall Hartley, came to preach the first sermon in the new hall. The members set about filling the 500 seats of the hall with evangelistic zeal. They even considered the possibility of inviting a Mr. Berry to conduct a mission in the neighbourhood. However, discretion prevailed when it was discovered that Mr. Berry's main claim to evangelistic fame was that he had been Bradford's public hangman. Meanwhile, the situation at Pevensey Road was becoming urgent. The ventilation of the building was quite insufficient when it was packed with summer visitors, and it was clear that the time had come for the Extension Committee's second part of their scheme to be put in hand. When it was made known that over £3,000 was promised for the provision of a new central church, the way ahead seemed to be clear. A very vigorous superintendent minister, the Reverend Daniel Heaton, took charge, with Carlos Christos at Crisford at his side, who was the architect. Very soon the money was beginning to come in. The foundation stone of the Sunday School, which was the first part of the project, was laid in April 1907, and people were encouraged to place shillings on the foundation stones. The target was 2,000 shillings towards the quarter of a million shillings that were needed. The following year, the foundation stone of the new church was laid, and when the spire was finally completed, some intrepid members, including children, were actually hoisted to its dizzy height to eat their breakfast up there. And the noble architecture filled the people's wildest dreams, and visitors flocked to admire it and to hear the spellbinding preaching of the new superintendent, the Reverend Harold Morton. However, the dream was in danger of becoming a nightmare. Mr. Morton puts it very simply. He says, unfortunately, the money which was steadily accumulated a few years ago for circuit extension was spent upon buildings in the east end of the town, and the present scheme, pushed forward too eagerly before money had been raised to pay for it, was found on completion to be burdened with a vast debt of £11,600. The task of fundraising was overwhelming. All kinds of fundraising efforts were undertaken. Some were obviously more successful than others. When the Reverend Harold Morton gave one of his famous lectures, he was paid £3, 3 shillings and sixpence for his effort, which was fine until the collection was counted and reached only just £2, 8 and 6. Something of the desperation which was felt at the time can be judged from an article that was written. And it said this: "There can, alas, be little doubt that Methodism in Eastbourne is in peril of entire disaster unless the golden river of money flows quickly to its help. No one would desire Methodism to disappear from the Empress of Watering Places, but disappear she must and will, if our new central church fails. However, much greater storm clouds were about to break. The First World War thundered across Europe, and for a time the church's local problems were submerged, if not forgotten. Many troops were billeted in the town, and these were given a warm welcome. Concerts were given by the choir, and the needs of the wounded soldiers in the convalescent camp at Summerdown were all taken care of. But all the time, the finances loomed in the background. In 1917, advertisements appealing for financial help appeared in the Methodist Recorder. At this point, we must pay tribute to Mr. W. Brown, who bore the brunt of the money raising. He was determined to clear the debt, and in pursuance of his aim, he refused to be abashed by refusals of help. "I had quite made up my mind," writes one exasperated correspondent, "that I should not be able to help you again, and I must request you to regard this donation as the last." But he did send Mr. Brown a guinea. The correspondence between Mr. Brown and the long-suffering Reverend John Hornabrook of the Chapel Committee bears testimony to the tenacity of the first and the patience of the latter. In letter after letter, Mr. Hornabrook points out that he cannot remember any occasion upon which help from Methodism had been given so generously to a church as it had to Eastbourne. But still Mr. Brown came back, Oliver Twist-like, and begged for more, until finally the connection had contributed nearly a quarter of the cost of the new building, and you can almost detect the note of relief when in May 1925 the debt was cleared, and a memorandum came from Mr. Hornabrook's office which said with fervent thanks, "We rejoice with you in the consummation of your great struggle." About 20 years after its opening, the church was at last free from debt. And during the last 17 of those years, the total monies raised for buildings, upkeep and interest had exceeded £30,000. Well, in June 1929, a civic service was held to celebrate the 21st anniversary of the new church's opening. A local report says that there was a picturesque procession of aldermen and councillors and, for some reason, the Inspector of Weights and Measures. And the choir rendered "O Breath of God, Breathe on Us Now," and the sermon was preached by the redoubtable Dr. Scott Lidgett. And to round off the celebrations, a plaque was unveiled to the memory of the soldiers who'd first brought Methodism to Eastbourne. Now, other matters were beginning to become important at a national level. Methodist Union was in the air. And in 1922, the three Methodist conferences, the Wesleyans and the Primitives and the United, sent down a scheme for discussion at circuit quarterly meetings. And when it reached Eastbourne, it received a very frosty reception. And Mr. Brown, now entering the theological lists, wrote to Mr. J. Arthur Rank, the famous Lord Rank, of course, later, to inform him of the situation. Mr. Rank, who had been a very generous benefactor to Central, wrote back to Mr. Brown very disapprovingly. "The fact of the matter is," he says, "there's a good deal of snobbishness among the Wesleyans." Anyway, Methodist Union was going ahead. And in Eastbourne, it was a matter between the Wesleyans and the Primitives, who'd left their Longstone Chapel in 1911 and had moved into an ex-congregational tin chapel at the corner of Whitney Road, where within a couple of years a new church was built and given the unusual name of St. Aidan's, because their minister, the Reverend John Clennell, was a Northumberland man and wanted to leave a memorial to the saint who'd brought Christianity to his part of the world. Just about that time, the time of the union question, it was put to the circuits, and the Primitive Methodist cause in Eastbourne became part of the Eastbourne Methodist circuit. To everybody's credit, no matter how much Wesleyans and Primitives had eyed each other with distrust beforehand, when the matter was decided and the reunited Methodists met in the Albert Hall to seal their union, the local Methodists entered into their marriage with grace. Wesley Hall was sold and the work was concentrated at St. Aidan's, just about the time that the worst horrors of the Depression years enveloped the neighbourhood. And even these horrors were soon to pale into insignificance, as once again the war clouds rolled across Europe. Eastbourne was declared a controlled area and thousands were evacuated from town, and just in time, because between October 1940 and June 1941 nearly 50 raids were recorded on the town. There are many stories of miraculous escapes from death during those raids, but particularly interesting for us was the story of the Birchfield family, who, like good Methodists, were in church on the 7th of July 1940, and returned home, intending to eat their Sunday dinner, but instead found that their home and their shop had received a direct hit, and had they been in it, they would almost certainly have been killed. It soon became clear that the chances of Central's escaping damage was very slim indeed, and it was decided to forsake the use of the church. The communion table and the furnishings were carried downstairs into one of the basement rooms. However, only on one occasion was there no service held, and that was when a £1,000 bomb fell in North Street and failed to explode, and the police cordoned off the area and the services were suspended in case the explosion should bring the spire down. As in the First World War, the Methodists devoted themselves to the welfare of the troops, and many thousands were given food and shelter in the forces canteen on the premises, which was manned by people of most of the Eastbourne churches. On Sunday nights, after evening service, there were Sunday night socials, and at 9 o'clock a lovely custom was observed. Everybody present would stand and sing the hymn, "Holy Father, in thy mercy, hear our anxious prayer. Keep our loved ones now far distant in thy care." And it said that many young servicemen who had been part of that wonderful fellowship would turn their thoughts towards Central at 9 p.m. on Sunday evenings, even when their duties had taken them to the most far-flung corners of the world. Although mercifully Central was spared any real damage, there was always a problem of strain, and the minister at the time, the Reverend Arthur Moore, found that his health broke down under the demands of his difficult ministry. And the Reverend Charles Danbury came to take his appointment. In a lovely letter he wrote to the church members at the time, especially those who were away from the town, he wrote, "The war will not last forever," but it must have seemed a long, long time before that prophecy came true. Nevertheless, it did come true, and in 1945 the members of the church began to return home. The mood of the country was to get back to normal as soon as possible, and there was a strange optimism abroad. Nationally, Methodism reflected that mood, and began to set in train a programme of expansion for Methodism to meet the new post-war challenges. And Central shared in that renewed hope, and so did the circuit. Open-air services were held, congregations rose, and youth work flourished. But it wasn't long before Methodism's restless evangelistic spirit was looking for other ways to expand its work, and it turned its eyes towards the new housing areas around Hampden Park. And in 1955, a Sunday school was started in Broderick Road Infant School, and the circuit took on the building of a new church building, and it's now St. Stephen's Church. If St. Stephen's Church was very new, then the circuit's next acquisition was of much older pedigree. The Methodist Society at Cross in Hand had been founded in 1896 as part of the Sussex Mission, and in 1968 it came into the circuit, which again rallied round to help to provide the funds to improve the premises. The second large post-war development took place at Langley, but it was a sign of the times that the approach to the challenge there was not on a Methodist basis, but an ecumenical basis, in the best tradition of Methodists as the friends of all and the enemies of none. And thus St. Barnabas United Church and Christian Centre came into the being. What then can be said by way of conclusion to this remarkable story? In these days, when we often feel that the influence of the church has declined almost to vanishing point, this history reminds us that our Methodist forefathers would have been amazed by the growth of the tiny seed which they've planted. We have even greater cause than they had to sing the joyful words of Joseph Hart's hymn, This is the God We Adore, especially the verse which reads, "'Tis Jesus, the first and the last, whose spirit shall guide us safe home. We'll praise him for all that is past, and trust him for all that's to come."